The idea of making it rich in America is still alive, but as the years go by, both of the country and us as individuals, we realize we'll probably end up not far from where we started. So if we start in poverty, our chances are not great. Is it even possible to create a system where the American dream is not just credible, but also attainable? The authors of a new book think so. Marjorie Kelly and Ted Howard are the authors of The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just the Few. Ted Howard and Marjorie Kelly are both leaders at the Democracy Collaborative, which is all about an economic system that is more equitable. Ted Howard is co-founder and president. Marjorie Kelly is executive vice president and senior fellow. Marjorie also co-founded Business Ethics Magazine and has written other books, including Owning Our Future. Marjorie Kelly is our guest. Thanks for joining us.
Jeffrey, thanks for having me.
So is the book essentially the manifesto of the Democracy Collaborative?
Yeah, in a way it is, Jeffrey, but it's also talking about the work of thousands of people who've been doing this work for decades, you know, doing impact investing and employee-owned companies and economic development that's for racial justice and on and on. And it's not yet recognized as a coherent paradigm, a way to organize an economy, and that's what we're trying to do.
You refer to yourselves as radicals, but radicals with your feet on the ground. That's a fun way to put it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I come from a business family. My dad owned his own business, so did my grandfather. And Business Ethics Magazine was a private company that I co-founded and ran for 20 years. So yes, I come at this as a business person, but recognizing that business can be a force for good, and it has to go down into the ownership and purpose of companies. And Ted travels the world and talks to municipal leaders, government leaders. We work a lot with nonprofit hospital systems and universities that together represent 9% of GDP, and they want to localize their purchasing, hiring, and investing. So, yeah, we're doing practical work in the real world while we also say, look, it is possible to have an economy that works for all of us and does so within planetary boundaries.
So, Marjorie, let's go to the place where your critics will likely go and go often. Are you talking about socialism here?
You know, it's great to bring that up because what I like to say is that capitalism and socialism, those are 19th century concepts. And we're stuck for some reason in this idea that our choices are binary, right? It's either capitalism or it's socialism. It's corporate capitalism, state socialism. And I don't think those choices are adequate to the challenges that we face. And what we're suggesting is that if you bring the principles of democracy, the public good, a concern for all of us, being in this together, if you bring those into the economy, into companies and investing and economic development, that's a different way to think about creating a good economy. Yeah, there's a room for public ownership. That's an important piece of it. We talk about publicly owned banks, for example, which might be considered socialist. And Bank of North Dakota, for example, has been around for 100 years. It's owned by the people of the state. Its purpose is to serve them, not to extract wealth from them. And it helped that state get through the 2008 downturn without a scratch. And there's now a movement for publicly owned banks around the country. So, yes, I would say public ownership, which is often seen as a pillar of socialism, that's an important piece. We also think employee-owned companies and B corporations. There are also private companies that are part of this. So it's a lot more than I think socialism is a narrow frame. I think I love the excitement of people, young people who are taking up this word and this cause. And what I think what they're saying is, we know we don't want capitalism.
Now, when I first saw you use the term extractive economy in the book, I was thinking, logging, timber, that kind of extraction. But you don't mean physical extraction. What do you mean?
Yeah, we contrast the democratic economy with the extractive economy we have now, which is designed for maximum extraction of financial wealth by an elite. You know, there's a study that shows 72% of Americans think the economy is rigged against them. And they're right. We talk in the book about how it's rigged. It's in policy where capital gains are taxed at a lower rate than income. It's in policy where we bail out the big banks, but not the people whose homes were underwater. And it goes down into the structure of companies, where companies are believed to be managed on behalf of wealthy shareholders and not for employees, the community, and the environment. So, yeah, so the extractive economy is everywhere around us, and we don't really see it or understand it. And we try to make it more visible and clear.
You call that a capital bias, but, you know, I would say one of the issues you're facing here is that that people with a lot of money do a lot to maintain the system because it works for them.
Well, I think that's right. And people, we talk about capital bias, which is largely unconscious. And I think it's important to recognize that. This isn't about evil people out to make other people miserable. I think it's unconscious in that it's embedded in institutions, it's embedded in policies, it's just embedded in business as usual, in the same way that I think that sexism used to just be embedded in the way people thought about the world. And certainly, you know, so we know about sexism, we know about racism, they're still here, there's a lot of work to be done, but at least they're considered illegitimate. And that isn't true of this third form of bias, which is capitalism. You know, this whole idea that organizing everything to benefit capital makes sense. It's a form of bias that I think we need to see is no longer legitimate.
You write about the country's founding. I mean, obviously, we got a few things left out, particularly for women and people of color at the dawn of the country. But any indication that the founders even thought about an economic system and how it would work? And it certainly isn't addressed in the Constitution, is it?
Yeah, that's right. Well, the word corporation appears nowhere in the Constitution because that really wasn't a very large part of the economy that they were concerned about. But, you know, the founding fathers, I mean, they thought that in bringing the king to heel, that they had solved the problem of inequality and of unfair privilege. And what happened in the 1800s was there was a new aristocracy that arose with the robber barons and the kings of capital. And they rose to prominence and have become the financialized economy of today. So
let's pause there because I want to pick this up on the other side of a break. So we'll leave it the aristocracy and come back. The book is called The Making of a Democratic Economy. Back with Marjorie Kelly in 1 minute. So where we left off was talking about the aristocracy that we thought we'd gotten rid of with England and the Revolution, and yet we ended up establishing our own aristocracy with the likes of J.P. Morgan, Cornelius Vanderbilt, John D. Rockefeller in the late 19th century.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jeffrey. That's well said. And so I think the way to think about it is that society long ago democratized government, but we've never democratized the economy. And that is what I suggest is the movement that's underway today. And I think it's really important to claim that language of democracy because that is the moral high ground. It's very different than regulation and social safety nets, which is how progressives tend to think of taming the economy. We're gonna leave the system in place as it is, and we're just gonna wrap regulations around it and put social safety nets underneath it. But that's like putting a picket fence in front of a bulldozer. I mean, the system is just gonna flatten those regulations, and that's what we're seeing today. And you know, this notion of democratizing the economy, Elizabeth Warren, there's a piece that the New York Times put out just today saying that Elizabeth Warren is talking about democratizing finance. I'm not suggesting Elizabeth read our book, but this language, I think it's a notion whose time has come, that we the people serving the people of the country, that's the purpose of finance. It's not extracting more money for the 1%.
So can the system be built atop the old one? Are we talking about actually clearing out some space, hollowing out the system we got now and moving into a new realm?
Yeah, it can. It can and it must. I mean, I think one of the things that it's important for us all to recognize, Jeffrey, is how the status quo is not going to endure forever. We know about climate change. That's bearing down on us. There are lots of indications that the stock market is pretty frothy, and there may be, people are talking about a recession may be coming. You know, it's not going to be smooth sailing ahead forever. And so the question is, do we have the ideas in place? When and if a next downturn comes, do we have the ideas in place that we can seize that moment and begin to move toward a democratic economy? I mean, one of the ideas that we mention in the book is the idea of public banks, for example. I mean, last crisis, we bailed out the big banks with, hundreds of billions, even trillions of dollars. And then when the dust cleared, we just put them back into their exact same ownership design as before, and they went back to their old shenanigans. And so there's an idea out there that Democracy Collaborative has put out, which is, if we have to bail out the banks again, let's keep them permanently in public ownership so that they're owned by the public and they have a duty to serve the public. That's a very different way of thinking about change.
So in The Making of a Democratic Economy, Marjorie Kelly and Ted Howard list the seven basic principles of a democratic economy, which we'll get to in turn: community, inclusion, place, good work, democratic ownership, which we just talked about, sustainability, and ethical finance. So it appears that the cooperative stuff is the key to the community principle. How widespread do you find co-ops and employee ownership setups?
More widespread than people recognize. There are about 11 million people who work at firms that have employee ownership, and there are roughly 7,000 firms that have some form of employee ownership. And some of them are surprisingly big. For example, in the Bay Area, there's a company called Recology. It is a waste hauling, recycling, and composting company.
It has franchises in our region, yes.
Yeah, excellent. It's 100% owned by its workers. The truck drivers in the Bay Area on garbage trucks are making $100,000. You know, if you're not siphoning off all this profit for shareholders, there's more money for workers. And this is a company that has, its vision is a world without waste. They see waste as a resource and want to put it to the highest and best use, as opposed to waste management, which just wants to get rid of it as cheaply as possible. So there are some very impressive examples of worker-owned companies.
So tell us about Nick Tilson and Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation with the Lakota.
Yeah, Jeffrey, that's one of my favorite stories, and it's one of the favorite projects I've worked on at the Democracy Collaborative. Ted and I worked for 5 years in Indian country, which is the phrase that people we worked with like to use. It's Native American nonprofits and development companies. And one of the people we worked with was Nick Tilson at Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation on Pine Ridge Reservation. And he's leading an effort there that is building a whole regenerative community. When this work first began, there wasn't a single house for sale anywhere on Pine Ridge. This Indian reservation had unemployment estimated as high as 80%. And when a dollar was landed anywhere on Pine Ridge, you would exit within 48 hours. You simply couldn't spend money there. And so Nick gathered the community together and did hundreds of hours of listening and said, what do you need? What can we at our CDC help build? And they realized they came out of this with a vision of the regenerative community. Last I heard, there were 13 houses that had been built, and that there youth are being trained in construction skills. As they build these houses, they created an employee-owned construction company. They don't want just white-owned businesses to come in and get all this business and get the wealth. They're going to have skate parks and powwow grounds, and it's a whole planned community that will have solar energy and recycle its own water. And Nick sees this as a model. It's the kind of development, I mean, you know, Nick could have said, I'm out to be a millionaire, but he didn't. He said, I want to serve the community. And so that's an example of the principle of community, and it's very different than the guys in Silicon Valley who are setting out to become billionaires, and meanwhile, one in three children in their own neighborhoods are going hungry.
Well, and the buy-in is fairly low, it seems like, at Thunder Valley, because you mentioned in the book that sweat equity is part of this. It's like a Habitat for Humanity model where you help build your house.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You can save money and take part in the building and reduce the cost of the home.
All right, so that addresses the community pillar, the community principle of the seven basic principles of a democratic economy. Let's move on to inclusion and talk about an Oregon case. Tyrone Poole and got named Oregon Entrepreneur of the Year.
Yeah, this is in Portland, Oregon, And yes, Tyrone Poole is a young African-American man. He was homeless at one point and got assistance from the Portland Development Commission to start his own company, which is no app fee. And it's all about matching people who are trying to find affordable housing with openings where they meet the criteria. And he developed a phone app for that and has launched a company that's attracted millions of dollars in equity. Yeah, he was Oregon Entrepreneur of the Year. And in that particular story, we look at how Portland Economic Development completely reoriented itself around inclusion, both racial inclusion and gender inclusion, because they realized that these are the people who have, people of color, women, have been left out of the economy as it is now. And they say, you know, if half of your body isn't working well, you don't have a healthy body. So they're focusing on those who've been excluded, and they've renamed themselves Prosper Portland.
Right. Yeah, I'm looking at their website right now, which is interesting that Portland, for all of its nationally renowned liberality, learned lessons anew about historic exclusion.
It's extraordinary when you dig into the history of Portland, that and of Oregon in general, of how racist it was in the past, and in some ways remains today. There was a law at one point that forbade blacks even to live in Oregon
at the founding of the state.
Right. It's astonishing. And Kimberly Branham, the director of Prosper Portland, she'll talk openly about the Tale of Two Cities. She has given that talk publicly, that Portland is seen as this progressive mecca, but there's, for people of color, it's a very different city.
We're talking to Marjorie Kelly, who with Ted Howard at the Democracy Collaborative, that's where they both work, wrote a book called The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just the Few. Register your thoughts about what you think about a world in which the economy is set up for people at the bottom as well as people at the top, or maybe we wouldn't even think in those terms anymore. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So let me restate the seven principles: community inclusion, place good work, democratic ownership, sustainability, and ethical finance. So we get to the principle of place, and this comes from Cleveland. So bring us back to earlier in the book, in the Evergreen Cooperative Laundry, which hired Chris Brown, who was in prison for selling drugs, and gave him a chance to make something of himself.
Yeah. Our organization, the Democracy Collaborative, helped design and launch the Evergreen Cooperatives in Cleveland. Now, this is a city. We have an office there, and this was a city that at one time had more Fortune 500 companies than any city except New York City, and workers there at one time made the highest wages in the nation. They were organized by unions. Well, there came a time when businesses and white people fled the city, and it lost more than half its population. And there were organizations that did not leave. We call them anchor institutions because they're anchored in place. It's like Cleveland Clinic, a big nonprofit hospital system, or Case Western University. They're not going to get up and leave. And these were right in the heart of Cleveland, and they looked around and said, well, we're not leaving, so what can we do to help the community that is here? And they began to use their resources, hiring, investing, purchasing locally to benefit the local community. And one of the things they did was they helped start the Evergreen Cooperatives. There are three worker-owned companies. There's a big indoor greenhouse growing lettuce and herbs, three football fields under glass. There's an Evergreen Cooperative Laundry, which hires more than half the workers are formerly incarcerated, and they're from the inner city around that area that's about 95% black. And so this is a company that is deliberately giving a chance to people who couldn't get a chance anywhere else. Yeah, and we talk about that in the book.
Well, and then local ownership certainly appears to be a major hedge against the business as usual in today's world, where you get corporations shopping for new cities. You know, Amazon was touting what it was going to do so well for two new places, and the people in Queens said, you know, we don't really want this.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, I mean, it's really bribery. You know, so they're saying, we're going to pick a city based on who's going to give us the biggest tax giveaway, which is extraordinary that this is considered business as usual. I mean, where's that money coming from? It's sometimes the schools are defunded or parks have less have less funding, street paving, pensions. You know, there are lots of things that city money can go to, and giving sometimes billions away to Amazon, which certainly doesn't need it. It's amazing that we settle for this, Jeffrey.
So while we're in the subject of place as one of the principles of a democratic economy, there's an important element here, which is to make sure that you have workers in that place that can do the job. And you reference pre-training for employees, the Step Up program in Cleveland. What's that about?
Yeah, this is University Hospitals. And so one of the things that we do, Jeffrey, to step back, is we work with nonprofit hospital systems all over the country. People may not know that most hospitals are nonprofit, and then some are also owned by the municipalities or counties. So that represents the vast majority of hospitals in the country. And there is a movement for them to think of themselves as anchor institutions. We're anchored in place. How can we use all of our resources to benefit place? We have a network of, I think it's 45 now, these big hospitals. If you put these hospitals and universities and colleges together, they represent about 9% of GDP. It's a pretty big sector of the economy. And so university hospitals, this is an example of them being an anchor. They're surrounded by these impoverished communities, mostly African American, and they said, how can we help people from who are our own neighbors get jobs here? And they created a program called Step Up to UH. They go out. They heard from people. They're intimidated to step into this, you know, huge gleaming tower. And so they went out to churches and out into the community and met with people and said, you know, we have entry-level jobs here at this hospital, and we need you, and we're willing to train you. And so they are bringing people from these communities through, I think it's like a 6 or 8 week training, and they teach soft skills. I sat in on some of these trainings and talked to people about, you know, yeah, when you're in your life, you're master of your fate. You do what you want. Nobody bosses you around. But at the workplace, it's different. You're supposed to do what you're told. You know, so these soft skills, understanding the culture and nuance of the workplace, is mostly what leads people to fail at work and these jobs. And so they're training people, and they have higher retention for these jobs. And it's been a real success for university hospitals.
Marjorie Kelly's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book with Ted Howard is called The Making of a Democratic Economy. In the chapter on good work, you describe a massive crisis of good work. What do you see as being amiss?
This is a very interesting point, Jeffrey. I mean, we're told that our economy is doing well. We say, well, you know, GDP is growing. Unemployment is low. It's around 4%. And the stock market is up. So what could be better? Those are the measures that we like to talk about. Well, what we don't talk about is the fact that 40% of jobs are now insecure. They're part-time, they're contract, they're contingent, self-employed, Uber-type jobs, 40%. And 47% of Americans cannot put together even $400 in an emergency. So people are asset poor, they're in insecure jobs. So $400, I mean, the average cost of a car repair is slightly more than $400. Your kid twists an ankle, you need to buy band uniforms. I mean, there's a million reasons you can think of why somebody might need $400. And the fact that people don't have it is frightening. I mean, people lose their jobs because their car breaks down and they can't get to work. So we ask ourselves, you know, why is this happening? This is something that we unpack in this chapter. We're talking about a worker-centered company, Cooperative Home Care Associates. And what would it mean if we had a worker-centered economy? Well, it starts by recognizing that we don't, that companies have been systematically expelling labor income and, in fact, labor itself for decades. I mean, we're sending jobs overseas. Companies were fighting unions. And now there's talk of robots and automating jobs. Well, robots are not the enemy. It's capital. Companies have this mandate. They have to, however much profit you had last quarter, you need to have more this quarter. And so they become more and more focused on where can we extract more profit. And that often means laying people off. It means paying lower wages. It means cutting income to workers any way that you can so that you can increase income to capital. That's built into ownership designs and the design of the income statement. And we don't recognize this. This is capital bias. I mean, the whole system is geared to give more money to capital and less to workers. And until we recognize that and begin to work on that at the level of the DNA of the economy, we're not going to solve it.
It's also what leads to things, as explicitly expressed by leaders of drug companies, to have them jack up the prices because they need to maximize the shareholder value. We'll talk more about how an economy would look different if Marjorie Kelly and Ted Howard got their way. Their book is called The Making of a Democratic Economy. You can join us by phone and email when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Those seven principles again: community, inclusion, place, good work, democratic ownership, sustainability, and ethical finance. And just as we were talking about current ownership patterns where you're trying to squeeze profits and often workers out of the company, we get to democratic ownership. So this is a good place to touch on what B corporations are. Tell us, Marjorie.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of B corporations. There are thousands of them around the world. These are companies that take into their legal DNA, an obligation to serve the public good. They call themselves for-benefit companies. They still make a profit. You have to do that to stay in business. But they balance that with mission, a mission of service to the public good. And there are some remarkable companies there. Clif Bar, Organic Valley is a B Corporation, and Dansko, which is shoes, and Equal Exchange in Massachusetts. There are lots of companies that have a dedicated mission of serving the public good, and many of them do choose to become B corporations to honor that.
Right. We have Ben and Jerry's and Seventh Generation and a couple of other that we could mention that people are aware of.
Yeah, those are good ones.
So you gave an example here of EA Engineering, which is a company that was set up the old way and yet transitioned to benefit corporation.
This is a story that goes back to Lauren Jensen, who's the founder of EA Engineering. He was at one time mentored by Rachel Carson and was a professor of ecological science. He ended up leaving the university and taking some biologists with him and founding an environmental consulting firm. And this was in the 70s, and we just had new clean air, clean water acts. There was a lot of demand for consulting, and all of their advisors said, you should go public. And they did. For over a decade, the shares of this company traded on NASDAQ. And they found that it virtually destroyed the company. The company got in trouble with the SEC over misstating earnings. They cycled through three presidents. They saw the morale of their biological scientists on staff collapse. Because this was a company that it lost its way. Instead of saying, we're here to help the environment, they were now here to create maximum quarterly returns for investors, and that meant sometimes hiding problems with projects. So those executives were let go, and the founder stepped in, bought the company back, and he transitioned it to 100% worker ownership, and it became a benefit corporation. That's a variation on the B Corp. It's in the state law of 34 states now, and it has been healthy ever since. This company has $140 million in revenue and hundreds of employees, and it got its soul back, and its mission is creating a better environment one project at a time. You know, and it's very hard to have a real mission like that of ecological service, of service to the public good, if you are completely owned by capital and your purpose is to maximize returns to capital. It's very hard to have any other real living beneficial purpose.
I don't know if you plan the pivot this way, but in the book we talk about EA Engineering and its environmental work just before we talk about sustainability and the idea of companies being able to continue. And it's in this chapter that you also bring up the idea of quantitative easing, or QE, for the planet. What is that?
Yeah, you know, so it's one thing to have a worker-centered economy. We certainly need that. That's a key to solving inequality. But we have these planetary boundaries, and how do we stay within them? That needs its own design. And one of the main impediments to solving climate change is the confusion and misinformation spread by places like ExxonMobil. I mean, they want to keep pumping oil. They've said they're going to double their earnings in the next 10, 15 years. So they're pretending that life is going to go on as usual. They're going to keep pumping all the oil that they can, and nothing will ever change. Well, we know that that's absurd, and yet they're capturing the political process. And so one of the ideas that we've hatched at the Democracy Collaborative is, what if the government went in and just bought out the 25 largest fossil fuel companies, bought 51% of them, and installed a new purpose, and that purpose is to preserve life on Earth, and let's just wind these companies down. This was an idea. It's a big out-of-the-box idea, and it was presented to one of our coworkers, Carla Scandier. She presented it to a group of environmental funders, and it was chosen as one out of three of about 600 applicants that got chosen for funding. And so we're building out this idea. It would cost about $700 billion, which is not a small amount of money, but you spread it over 7 years, it's $100 billion a year. That starts to be more manageable. It's far less than the $1.5 trillion that Donald Trump gave away in tax breaks to the wealthy. And so we're building out this idea. I mean, it's, you know, ideas that can seem radical now can become very practical in an emergency. I think this is one of the premises that we operate on, is what are the big ideas that we need to have lying around that might find a time when they become much more doable.
Marjorie, we had talked earlier about the Bank of North Dakota. It ends up in the chapter about the last of the seven principles of a democratic economy, ethical finance.
Mm-hmm.
Is it ethical just because it is publicly owned, or is it also oriented differently?
Well, it's really about, I think, purpose and ownership. Bank of North Dakota is one I like to point to. It is owned by the people of the state. And so, therefore, it operates differently. It aims to serve the people, and it keeps lots of locally owned banks in operation. There's more than five times as many locally owned banks in North Dakota per capita as there is elsewhere in the country. But it's not the only example. Ethical investing, or impact investing, as it's often called, is another way to have ethical finance. We were strategic advisors to the launch of the Fund for Employee Ownership in Cleveland at the Evergreen Cooperatives. It has raised over $11 million now, and is going to be buying companies in Northeast Ohio and transitioning them to employee ownership and making some money for shareholders along the way. So there are lots of ways that we can do ethical finance. It means remembering that finance doesn't exist just to pile up more and more money. It exists to serve the public good. It exists to help create a better society for all of us.
Let's take some contact from listeners here. We'll go to a phone call from Donna in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Marjorie Kelly, the co-author of The Making of a Democratic Economy. Hi, Donna.
Thank you. How interesting. How familiar are you with the economic policies of Andrew Yang, a candidate?
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with them.
Well, how about universal basic income by that name? I imagine you've had some dealings with that.
Yes, universal basic income. That is an idea that's out there, which says that if we're losing jobs, if income for workers is stagnant, then people, we need to guarantee a minimum quality of life for people with universal basic income. I certainly wouldn't be opposed. I support the idea that everyone deserves a minimum quality of life. I think that's vital. The principle I support. What I worry about with UBI is it would take so much money to guarantee people even about $10,000 a year, which you can't live on that. Even to do that level would take pretty much the equivalent of all the money the government spends every year. And so what I worry about that is that it's an idea that keeps us, it's not likely to be enacted, and it keeps us, I think, in a thinking that we can just leave the system to function as it is, and we're going to wrap the ultimate social safety net around it, and that's going to solve the problem. And so what I'm suggesting is that I don't think a huge social safety net is going to be the solution. I think we need to attack the problem at its DNA. We need to go inside companies and say, look, you cannot continue to extract all this money from workers. Workers need to have asset ownership. I would favor that more as an approach.
Another call from Skeeter in Eugene. It looks like you also want to talk about Andrew Yang. You want to take it a little further?
Yeah. Thank you very much for a great program, by the way. Thank you. I've often, over the years, I've thrown out this idea on your program, and it's basically, what if a county elects people, citizens, who say, hey, elect us and we're going to do this? And what you do is you basically create kind of a people's monopoly currency. Imagine playing Monopoly where the county actually just, you know, creates a currency, and it's legal to do this, creates a currency where you basically distribute, oh, let's say $1 million, $5 million to every citizen in the county. And the whole point of the game is for everybody and everything, including Bambi and the watershed, to be okay. That's the point of the game. And then you basically encourage people to develop educational systems, services, products, using materials from the local watershed in a sustainable way. And it's basically like playing Monopoly, but the point is for everybody to be okay, and the game is not over until everybody's all right.
All right, Skeeter, thanks for that. So the local currency, what do you think about that, Marjorie?
Well, I like the idea of a game. If I'm thinking of this as conceptual rather than literal, I like the idea of building economic literacy and thinking, you know, yeah, how can we use the basic tools of the economy to make sure that we all do well, including the natural world? That is the way we need to start thinking, and we need to begin become literate about it. So I think I'm all in favor of whatever we can do to build economic literacy.
We have a corrective email from Jenny, no town given, who points out that Ben and Jerry's sold to Unilever around the year 2000. So Unilever showcases Ben and Jerry's as independent and mission driven, but Jenny says not sure what that means when it's a subdivision of a transnational chemicals and consumer goods corporation. Thank you for that. We also have an email from Becca in rural Lane County, who wants to know about the ownership end of things. Where do the company contributions to IRAs, 401ks, et cetera, fit in? These are middle-class benefits as well as for the wealthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Well, so just to go back to the Ben and Jerry's piece just for a moment. Yes, I was editor of Business Ethics when that happened and was part of a lot of dialogue. There was an attempt of impact investors to buy out Ben and Jerry's, and Unilever bid higher and won the deal, which is unfortunate because there was an attempt to keep that into progressive ownership. And it does point to the importance. I mean, B Corps are great, but it's also important to say who actually owns the company, because that has an important effect. And there are companies that don't decide to sell to a big company like Unilever. Beer companies, for example, New Belgium, rather than selling to Anheuser-Busch, Kim Jordan, the founder, sold to her employees. And she made plenty of money, and the employees built wealth. So there is another way to exit. So that's one thing. And then, Jeffrey, remind me, what was the email?
Becca wanted to know about, what do you do with corporate contributions to 401ks, IRAs, et cetera, because those help the middle class, not just the top end.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think that those kind of contributions, and I think building a basic retirement for the middle class, that's what we need. That we need more wealth to be held in the hands of the middle class. We've seen the middle class basically be hollowed out, and all the assets have gone to the top. So, and ESOPs, by the way, employee stock ownership plans, are essentially a retirement contribution by companies. So when companies sell to an ESOP, a founder exits by selling to an ESOP, which is what Kim Jordan did at New Belgium, the employees receive their shares of the company as a retirement benefit. So it creates an additional retirement portfolio for companies. And on average, those retirement portfolios in ESOP shares are about $140,000. So yes, whatever we can do to rebuild the wealth of the middle class, that's what we need to do.
So the major principles, again, community, inclusion, place, good work, democratic ownership, sustainability, and ethical finance, all leading up to The Making of a Democratic Economy, the book by Marjorie Kelly and Ted Howard of the Democracy Collaborative. Marjorie has been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange today. Very much appreciate your time.
Jeffrey, thanks for having me. I'm going to be in Portland August 19th at one of the Powells, so I hope people will come out and see me.
August 19th in Portland. Okay, thanks again, Marjorie.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
That will do it for today's exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. Our producers are John Baxter and April Ehrlich of JPR News. Student assistant Randy Babbitt is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you again for listening. Please join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange. Have a great day.